This is an example of speech.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free from oversight and free of charge, thoughtfully improvised, expletive deleted, details expanded, whistle blowhard evergreen topical heatwave of a weekly conversation turned podcast in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, literature, social media, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comment section in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. I'm Peter Elbro. You can contact me on Twitter at BloatedNemesis. And I have with me, as always and forever, Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at Green_Weird, which is WYRD. This episode, we have our weekly intro segment, Weak Thoughts, about Google Finance, Facebook, and the Resistance. A discussion of minor league baseball labor laws. You know, to celebrate opening day of baseball. Yeah. A hip-hop test drive of the new album by MERS, A Strange Journey into the Unimaginable, and updates on Rotten Cabinetry, Palantir, MBS, and more. Much more. Prepare to get royally revolutionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. Now, for some weak thoughts. And don't wonder what profit really means. It follows in advance from the ivory tower. Waste your life in a struggle for power. All men thus reduced to fleas. So fuck it, just do whatever you please. All right. Welcome to Tell Me What to Think. I am bunkered down in my basement, hiding from children. How are you doing, Charles?
I'm okay. Another gray day here in southern Wisconsin. Apparently, I just got an email. Mark Pocan is going to be in the area today, like a couple blocks away from my house, so I might go down there.
Oh, sweet. What in regards to what?
Town hall. He's going to the local public library for a town hall.
So he's a politician that does town halls.
Yeah, it's...
How novel.
Right, it's... When you're actually kind of popular in your district, it doesn't feel like a security threat to go face a bunch of angry people.
Yes, exactly. Before we move further, we urge everyone to like and subscribe and click notifications and write reviews and tell your friends and...
Wax poetic.
Write us letters, snail mail, retweet and Facebook share, and I don't know.
Passenger pigeon, I guess, for the people who are outside of the range of the internet now.
Make sure to send floppy disks taped to the back of pigeons to your friends out in the boondocks. All right. So... This past week, seems like a lot of the news has still been involved with these tech companies. Of course, 60 Minutes had Stormy Daniels. Is there anywhere you wanted to start?
Well, it seems like the deja vu is continuing. All of these stories that we keep getting fed are based in shit that happened a fucking year ago. Sorry, I'll stop swearing. Just frustrating when they're not really reporting any new news, but they're reporting it as though it is new.
What's the first thing that springs to mind when you say
Stormy
that?
Daniels? Like, they keep rehashing and rehashing, and admittedly it's interesting, but they're not... Like, the reporting doesn't seem to be getting at, like, the parts of the action that are potentially against the law, like where the money came from. Right now it's just getting... bogged down in, like, a legal soap opera of Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels suing and counter-suing each other.
Well, I mean, did you watch the 60 Minutes interview? They spent time with a campaign finance lawyer. I mean, he had airtime.
No, I didn't watch it, but I'm just kind of looking at the reporting of the 60 Minutes report itself. Like, I'm sure those people, those are OG journalists. They're just going to do what is... They're going to do the work required, and people are going to take whatever soundbite they want out of it for secondary reporting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's kind of, sensationalism
porn star talks about president. There's the headline.
And you're done for the day.
You know, I heard a point made about that I thought... Okay. Just to back up for a second. The real story that we're referring to is that there's campaign finance issues with Stormy Daniels, for those who are not aware. And it's that his lawyer paid her money. And actually, the guy on 60 Minutes was making the point that it might actually be more egregious if Michael Cohen wasn't paid to pay that money. That it might be more egregious if he just wasn't, because then it's like a pure donation.
Right, and then it's conspiracy, too.
But anyways, I heard the point made that... and it reminded me of a previous episode of the podcast, where we talked about the weaponized indecency of Trump and his ilk. And the thing I heard pointed out by someone was that a porn star is a little bit immune to that. Although if you listen to the 60 Minutes interview, she does say that stuff does affect her and her family somewhat, but still, it's going to affect her less just by nature of what she does than, say, you know, someone who's not in porn.
Right, the career kind of forces a thick skin upon you.
Yeah, and she also just, I've seen, I don't follow her on Twitter, but I've seen little retweets of hers where, you know, she has a little bit of a weaponized indecency thing going on herself. And so
her own indecency, though, instead of like trying to shock other people, which is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, there was like a little thing. Someone's like, what should I eat during your 60 Minutes interview? She's like, well, tacos and mini corn dogs seems appropriate, but popcorn would be good too, or something like that. So, you know, she knows how to take stabs with the best of them. So with all the tech company stuff going on, there was a Guardian article about restructuring Facebook, which saw you link out.
Yeah.
And
Matt Stoller and Barry Lynn, right?
Sure. And I don't know if you had any thoughts about how to, kind of broadly speaking, how to handle this. I mean, some people say it should be like treated as a utility. That some people just think there just needs to be more regulations. Then you have, you know, problems of free speech. It kind of strikes me that if it was a utility, there'd be less ability to restrict speech,
right,
if that's what you're going for. And so I don't know. What were your thoughts on it? And we'll kind of get to more about the tech company shenanigans in the last segment, but.
Well, right now, like, the tech companies have, well, I guess for the past decade or so, they've had all the cards in their hand. They've been able to use their extensive lobbying and, shall we say, social media presence to force a narrative that they are above regulation and that everything they're doing is above board. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it takes, like, one especially egregious example to come out, and suddenly we're questioning all of it. Because people don't, I mean, just, alright, let me back up. For the whole crux of that is just monopolization, like the antitrust laws. Like, the tech companies are way ahead of federal regulation in that respect, because they created a market that hadn't even been researched in, with any strength or energy.
Yeah.
And now that we have that data, we can begin to look at it and be like, wait, these guys are just meat packers. This is just, like, the shit that caused Upton Sinclair to, you know, try to make half of America vegetarians.
Yes. The jungle.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I hear stomping upstairs. What you just said makes me think that it might just be a simpler solution to just do, like, old-fashioned...
Yeah, break antitrust. Like, Facebook is way too valuable. Like, it's,
yeah,
its oscillations like cause like percentage drops and or increases in the Dow Jones when, yeah, mm-hmm. It's not really that important to the global economy.
But that might be easier and something that there's more experience in Washington, both legislatively. I mean, granted, not that much recent experience, but at least case law and all that. And then there's actual government institutions set up to do that, whereas regulating like the content and the how of what they do might be a little bit more troublesome because there's
some very very touchy First Amendment issues of speech and assembly.
And then even just like the technology itself, I think on one of the previous episodes of the show, we talked about how retweeting images, you know, like the hyperbolic explanation, retweeting images is a federal crime now. And I mean, obviously that's not really what it was, but, you know, a lot of this stuff's still being played out in courts. The Congress are obviously full of old people who Lindsey Graham, you know, doesn't even send emails, you know, all those people.
He famously gave out his own phone number, his phone number got leaked. Sorry, I didn't mean to say he put out his phone number, but...
And I just think, like, getting to the brass tacks of not worrying about what the business does so much as its size and its market share. And
a lot of that, a lot of these issues would be, you know, pieced together or pieced out in court proceedings, but these companies use arbitration and every public relations tactic that they can to keep themselves out of court, and any judge from asking any serious question like, is it a violation of somebody's First Amendment or protections if somebody else mentions them on Twitter? Is that defamation? But you know, freedom of assembly.
Yeah, I mean, do you have a freedom of assembly through the internet?
Shouldn't it be? Aren't your friends the people that you follow? Isn't that just freedom of assembly? Even if you're not following,
I think so.
Because, I mean, I follow at least one person I know. I pointedly don't like just because, you know, but does that association impact me and how people view me is a touchier question. And if that view does lead to negative impacts to my own life and well-being, is that actionable under civil law?
I wonder if in freedom of assembly it's a two-way thing. Or can I just, like, assemble with you, but you don't want to assemble with me? Is that...
Like, if that's kind of the internet works a lot of the time. Standing out next to each other in public, is it just a bunch of people standing there, or some people said to be assembling?
Yeah.
Is it all of them, none of them?
And, like, I'm calling you my friend, and you're like, I don't know who this dude is.
Mm-hmm.
But you haven't blocked me yet? I mean, I don't know how this... Anyway, speaking of big tech companies, you had some thoughts on Google Finance?
Yeah, Google Finance did this huge redesign where they kind of buried all of their information, and the information that they provide is like a third of what they used to, and it infuriates me.
What's it focused on now?
It's focused on large markets. Like, before, I don't know if you've ever seen this, but before, it kind of looked like a maze of numbers. Like, with my kind of academic and personal background, it's relatively comprehensible. Like, you know, I understand what these market or where these markets are, what these bonds mean, like what fluctuations in currency portend. But they've without that kind of if you don't know the question to ask, you're not going to get valuable information. They won't show you graphs. You can't do the comparisons like that. Make it easy to, for instance, one thing that I've been doing over the last few months is monitoring Turkey's currency, the lira, because it's involved in several geopolitical events, and it's been having some problems recently, as it's been jumping up to historical highs against the dollar with our, you know, deteriorating relationship. But now you couldn't do that. Like, you couldn't get that comparison between, okay, what's the Turkish lira trading at against the dollar, the euro, and the Russian ruble. It's three major trading partners. But now I guess you have to have a Bloomberg terminal to access that kind of information. The point that I want to make is that this influences the moment of inspiration. You can talk about the marketplace of ideas and how people can adopt or, you know, disregard ideas at willy-nilly, but there's all ideas come from that moment of inspiration, that combination of academic knowledge, data, personal experience, and, I don't know, weather, that allows somebody to develop some these incoherent data points into an idea that they can use however they want to. But this kind of, like, imposing these kind of restrictions on financial data keeps people who might be trying to become more financially literate in international finance and, like, the stock market from achieving any genuine mastery over the fundamental issues.
Well, yeah, I mean, so you said, I mean, was that completely serious when you said you have to have a Bloomberg
terminal? I mean, yeah, kind of. I've been trying to find a substitute for, you know, the currency evaluations that I try to make, and there aren't, you know, free products available out there, except maybe, well, Yahoo Finance, but again, the comparisons aren't that robust.
Yeah.
That's
that really bothers me.
Yeah, I mean, especially when Google, in many ways, has been, and it's definitely been vocal about trying to be this, egalitarian, open source of information to all, regardless, as long as you can get on Google.
Yeah, but Chris Hemsworth's age and birthday isn't necessarily as useful to me as, like, some stock prices and how they're fluctuating.
Well, yeah, and then the fact that they would not just, like, redesign it to put a priority on something, but it sounds like they just don't even have this info available. Mm-hmm. I wonder, did they give a public reason why?
The thing that they said is that they were redesigning the portfolios, which means to me that they weren't interested in keeping everybody's financial data on their own servers anymore. But that doesn't explain to me why they're not continuing to provide these data feeds when it's obviously it's obvious they're still collecting the data. But maybe it's just the fact that they don't want to compete with certain companies. But this, again, shows you why Google, being a huge data company like this, should be broken up into its various segments, because it's now restricting its kind of, well, fringe services or, you know, not core business services, so that they won't compete against other companies that, you know, I guess they're trying to make room for in the marketplace.
Yeah.
And that's my rant.
Well, that's a shame. End rant. Well, speaking of forms of classism, there's an unfortunate bit of patriarchal control going on in Indiana, even with Mike Pence not there. Apparently that's just still really popular.
Well,
there.
Indiana's a remarkably conservative state for its, you know, geographical positioning. They had a lot of, like, the demographics of Indiana are interesting because when they adopted a non-unionized workforce, they suddenly got an influx of workers from south of the Mason-Dixon line. Like, our executive producer lived in Elkhart and witnessed this firsthand in the RV factories, which led to the conservative bent of Indiana, or to become even more conservative, and people like Mike Pence, that polished conservatism is super-duper popular there.
Yikes. Well, they passed a law requiring doctors to ask about past abortions with all female patients, even when they go in for mental health.
No, it's like they ask for anything that they go into, they ask if it's any kind of mental or physical complication of a previous abortion, and then they have to take that data and record it and give it to the public health department, or let me get the proper name in front of me, but yeah, whatever Indiana's they're going to submit it to the CDC, which is part of the problem. Like, this is an interesting data problem. They're collecting intentionally misleading data to reinforce a certain conclusion from it.
Well, and supposedly it's a broader definition of these complications than, I mean, Indiana, their governor's like, 27 other states do this, which in this country isn't very reassuring, but yeah, supposedly this is a broader definition of complication.
Right, and it's, you know, I can see why the public health departments might need to keep track of, like, you know, immediate abortion complications, because if all of a sudden there's some disease or, like, some procedural mistake creeps into their operations and it causes even one woman to suffer any kind of complications, they need to know and should react accordingly. But it sounds like this is just trying to create connections where they don't necessarily exist. And,
yeah,
you know, creating that false context, again, you know, bakes in a bias in the later data sets that you produce from it.
Yeah, and they're also broadening their definition of fetal personhood.
Right, taking it all the way back from conception from, what was it, 24 weeks? Yeah, 24 weeks from gestation.
Yep. So, yeah. Those are the baby steps towards...
I assume this is probably going to get laughed out of court, but if it's already in 27 other states, it's going to be tougher than, you know, any kind of new and novel abortion restriction that they would try to pass. But this is like one of those long-term things where they're creating data so that 3 or 4 years later they can be like, oh, look, we have this data that abortion causes all of these complications, and so we should outright ban abortion for public health.
Yeah, it's just all part of, you know, you just keep shooting until something hits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just keep taking shots any way they can to fight off Roe v.
Kind of
Wade.
A dangerous adaptation.
And they're actually pretty explicit about it, too. Like, this hasn't been a secret strategy for the past 30 years.
These people consider themselves in a culture war, and they are acting like it, doing everything well, up to and including shooting people, huh?
Yeah, luckily that hasn't been as much of a thing recently.
Right.
That was the reaction there for... Yeah, that was back in the
90s? Yeah, remember Oklahoma City, the guy who bombed a bunch of abortion clinics down there? What was his name?
Mm-hmm.
Eric... not Eric Holder. That name just stuck in my head, but...
It's not Eric Holder.
Eric Rudolph?
Who was that? Was that Eric Holder, the abortion clinic bomber?
No. But yeah, that guy.
okay. It's funny. Sorry. And then I think I just wanted to finish up Weak Thoughts with broaching the subject of the Resistance.
Oh, man.
It's something that gets brought up a lot on, definitely on social media.
Should I bring up Funder's website for the counterpoint, or?
Yeah, I mean, but the Resistance... Well, first of all, I just want to point out that it's a Star Wars reference, right? It's a Star Wars reference. It's... People watched The Force Awakens, Donald Trump was election,
Resistance
elected...
came before Force Awakens, right?
Did it?
When was Force Awakens?
Force Awakens came out in... Hold on. I gotta look this up.
We have the internet in front of us. We shouldn't just talk out of our...
Yeah, it came out in 2015.
Oh, okay, so. So people saw Force Awakens.
And then Donald Trump was elected. They're like, he's as evil as Snoke. And, what did they do in Star Wars? Well, they had the Resistance. So I like the name. The problem is, it's not really organized.
Yeah, it's kind of the, well...
theoretical.
Well, the problem is that it might be over-organized in some others, on, you know, from a different angle. Like, this is the problem that was revealed in the next Star Wars movie, where the incompetence and, shall we say, static decision-making on the part of the Resistance leadership caused them to lose every goddamn ship in the fleet when they didn't fucking need to. Like, you guys couldn't have done this before? Like, the thing that you ended up using to get away? There is no reason you couldn't have used that strategy before and saved hundreds of people and thousands, like, dozens of ships that you would probably find useful later.
I see that you're on Team Poe.
God, it was so stupid.
Yeah. So, spoilers. So, I had written down here the three kind of questions you need to delineate for the Resistance, which is what people think it is, what it should be, and what it is. Let's do what it should be first, because I think we probably have a clearer idea of
that. Right, it should be an asymmetrical information distribution network so that people can find out what policies are being enacted and then provide some crowdsourced solutions or responses that could impede, shall we say, the more fascist tendencies of our new administration.
Should it be monolithic?
That's why I'm saying it should be asymmetrical, because obviously if we rely on the elites... Okay, so this is the problem with, like, relying on one or two people amongst a huge data group, is because those people are bound to make mistakes, and that if we depend on them and their mistakes, it's just going to get compounded the farther out it spreads, which keeps any resistance from responding with any authority and, shall we say, agility.
So, and that's kind of how you'd pick, like, which issues?
Well, I mean, that's just up to the people. This as being a crowdsourced thing, we have to depend on people caring about these individual issues and doing something in response.
Yes. So, and should it be... I don't think it necessarily should be tied to... And I think this is what you're addressing. It shouldn't be necessarily tied to the Democratic Party, per
Absolutely
se.
Absolutely not, because obviously some Republicans might have some problems with what's going on.
Yes. Oh, for sure. Yep. So then... well, and then the last thing about what it should be is, should it be, okay, so, obviously it's going to be focused on sort of, Trump administration and then opposition to Trump administration, like, on, like, the national stage. Should there be, like, a purity test? Should there be a, it being asymmetrical, it being crowdsourced, I mean, some people are going to care about something, people are going to care about other things. I mean, I would say the politicians would have the same freedom.
Sure.
I've heard this criticism of, like, because you brought up Republicans, like Jeff Flake. Like, Jeff Flake isn't part of the Resistance because he votes 95% the same with Trump.
Huge...
It's like, well, he's a fucking super conservative Republican.
Huge Trump score.
Yeah, but I mean, most of those things they vote for are things that he would vote for no matter what. Because that's what he's always wanted and thought. And I don't even mean so much, like, the things that get the press, but I mean, like, yeah, he's going to vote for pro-life judges because he's pro-life.
Or he's going to vote for insane oppressive security because he's from Arizona and is for insane oppressive security.
Yeah, and... But there's other things that he, you know, might disagree, of course, with the president on. In his case, immigration and kind of rhetoric things, which rhetoric doesn't really have a voting record, you know? Like... They don't pass bills saying, I don't like the way the president tweets. That's not something you vote on in the Senate.
Right. That's why we got to stick to policy, because these motherfucking I'm cursing so much, because these politicians will say anything, and it isn't until it's, you know, that quantum state is collapsed into an actual vote, that we know what they actually mean and believe.
Okay, and then what is the resistance? Like, what... the way it is working out right now...
I mean, I think there's a lot of people... say what you will, but I do listen to a lot of, shall we say, far-left-wing media, and there seems to be a lot of frustration out there with what people think is the resistance. And I would like to add, I am proud of the fact that I am blocked by Scott Dvorak on Twitter.
So tell people who that is.
Scott Dvorak is a... His Twitter handle is @Funder. He carved himself his own little niche of funding the resistance and being a mouthpiece for it. I mean, I actually don't get to see what he has to say about very much, but he is personally profiting from money that people are donating to, you know, the cause, the resistance, to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars. Like, the last article I saw said he personally made like about $76,000 off of the money that was donated to his organization. And it's just like charity,
so
most of the operating fees are subsumed into his own pocket instead of actually doing the work.
Yeah, so this guy has been a low-level, obscure Democratic fundraiser. He has some sort of pack or some shit like that.
Yeah, these guys are finance guys.
But he hasn't been a big one, and I don't know if it's chicken egg here in terms of Facebook, Twitter following, and then like prominence. But at some point here, he claims to be the founder of the resistance. Last I checked his Twitter bio, which is, you know, as opposite of your asymmetric proposal as there is. This dude just clicked. He's on MSNBC a lot. He's on fucking like Joy Reid and those shows. And he, in terms of the content on Twitter that he does, it's like kind of retweeting, but like not actually retweeting news stories, but like, because, you know, God forbid we give journalist outfits clicks. But, you know, just like bits of news. He's always super hyperbolic.
Yeah, I've noticed that. Like,
we've all been.
It's kind of like worse than empty context if you, like, carve off a lot of the context necessary to understand these data points.
Yeah. And so, anyway, I think he's what you're pointing to as an example of what the resistance is, like, the downside of it. I don't think most people who would identify with the resistance, like, are giving money to this guy or are any sort of lockstep with him or
this
people
guy,
like
just
him.
An easy example. But, I'm sure he's not the only one doing that.
Yeah, for sure. And, like, if you go on the Twitter, you see this a lot. # the resistance, or they put it in.
Yeah, I only use it ironically.
Proud member of the resistance. And I'm as anti-Trump as they fucking get. I hate him. And I hate him purely on a resist level. I just don't like... If he embodies something, I don't like that thing. I don't care what it is. I have no sympathy for Trump. And it's beyond policy for me. I just think he's a terrible human being. And I don't think we should elect terrible, terrible, the worst human beings as president. I'm sorry.
Oh,
but
Mr. Standards here. Ooh la la.
Yeah. But at the same time, like, I totally understand that being the president means you will probably do something bad. I don't think we in this age can have a president that will be 100% morally upstanding while president, or even to get to
the
presidency.
Yeah, I think that's the problem, is that you have to be immoral basically to get to the presidency.
Or at least somewhat. Anyway, that all being said, this group identity thing of the resistance to me is just foolish.
Go ahead. What are you saying?
I just don't think it. I think it. it gives you it's too branded is I think the problem, and it keeps others who might have a problem with Trump from joining it because there's too much association with other issues. So like, let's say I am sort of like a never Trumper type person, but you know, maybe didn't identify as that, but like, you know, maybe I even voted for him. And now it's a year or so in, and I'm like, oh man, I just can't do it again. You don't want to even hear from these people who are part of the resistance because you view them as something. But if they were just a big, huge crowd of people that just didn't like Trump, that might be easier to become a part of.
Well, yeah, because they seem to like...
But the branding... Well,
the branding leads to like them focusing on certain issues, and as you pointed out, that never Trump Republican who may have in the end held his nose and voted for him, like, suddenly maybe he works for a company as a middle manager for somebody who imports or exports from China and suddenly might lose his job behind that. But, you know, he cares about... But
yeah,
the focus on gun rights like just turns him off from the resistance entirely.
Yeah. And that's the thing, too, is that I don't think the resistance actually should be... If you're going to have something like that, I think it should be an extreme... This is kind of my last thought. I think it should be a really broad thing that is just what it says it is. It's a resistance. It is resisting the impulses and the existence of Trump. But it's not necessarily an issue-oriented liberal cause.
Right.
Because to me, getting Trump out of office is has the ability to be a really broad coalition because he's so offensive on so many levels that it's not because he's willing to vote, you know, to put forth pro-life judges or he's willing to take some NRA money. It's just the whole spectrum of why he does things and how he does things. It's not so much what he does. We've had shitty Republican presidents. And we will have shitty Republican presidents, hopefully not
yeah.
2020. But, and I just think, I think that narrow branding plays to his
and
strength.
I think that's part of the reason.
Trump.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the reason that this branding is bound to fail, because if this were, how do I want to say this?
Like,
if this were as broad as like an anti-war movement, like just focused on a fundamental change, I could see it getting a lot wider
yeah.
support, but the fact that the resistance is branding itself in like just kind of like, shall we say, strangely niche areas, like in calling for very specific policy proposals, keeps them on the right side of certain donors, you know? Like the mainstream Democrats can embrace, quote, the resistance, unquote, and still collect money from defense contractors and vote for far more money than Trump even asked for, but still be part of the resistance somehow.
Yeah, I think your anti-war analogy is the best one. Because if you look at something like the last... I mean, the Iraq war, anti-war thing kind of fizzled out.
Fucking
damn it. Go on that long. But if you look at, like... yeah, I know. It's, like, really big sore spot here. But if you look at, like, Vietnam, like, you had a wide range of people who were... It wasn't necessarily the majority at all times.
Right,
but
you could be
a wide range
and just hate war entirely, or you could be a realist and be like, this war doesn't even suit our interests. We're just wasting money and lives down a dark hole that against a domino effect that isn't even proven in reality, you know?
Yeah, and like you could have like religious leaders. You know, people who mm-hmm. disagree on other
yeah,
issues.
A broad-based coalition. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, no, I like that one. Like, we're at war with Trump. Don't care about your other issues. But
I mean, care about your issues, because, you know, at the end of the day, you have to,
well, yeah,
to advocate
but,
for yourself,
yeah.
And that's
so, of course.
Kind of the beauty of our democracy. But,
But when it comes to this one thing, we're just going to focus on... I mean, actually, I think the gun control thing right now, those kids
yeah,
are doing
they are.
A
They're
good
really,
job.
The media is trying to tangle it up into them and their personal politics, which is
yep.
kind of like trying to smother yep. the whole movement, but I don't think it's going to be successful.
Mm-hmm. No, they are really... They remind me of some... in fact, I think I was listening to a podcast where they explicitly talked about some of their influences being the anti-war protests of the 60s and the civil rights movement, MLK. They
yeah.
were... in terms of, yeah, being creating a broad coalition over a single issue.
Nonviolent,
yeah.
Non-cooperation, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
The Whiz Kids had won it, Bobby Thompson had done it, and Yogi read the comics all the while. Rock and roll was being born, marijuana we would scorn, so down on the corner the national pastime went on trial. Talking baseball, Klazuski, Campanella, talking baseball, the man and Bobby Feller, the scooter, the barber and the nuke. They knew them all from Boston to Dubuque, especially Willie, Mickey and the Duke. Well, KC was winning, Hank Aaron was beginning, one Robbie
all
going
right
out, one coming in.
Kiner and Midget Goodell. A few days ago, the U.S. Senate, House of Representatives, passed a omnibus spending bill. I'm going to get off on a tangent right away. How come I've never heard anything called an omnibus spending bill before this? Why is this an omnibus?
And that's what they always pass. It's not a new term. Yeah.
They're always omnibus. Why was?
Yeah, it's like they package all of the spending measures under one, so for conference purposes.
Why am I hearing the term omnibus way more right now in the past week than I did last time they passed a bill? I don't know. All right.
That's an interesting question that I guess we'll have to save for another segment.
Every time I see shit pass, I don't know, there's always just different lingo they're just throwing out that technically has been around, but they didn't use last time. It's like a...
I think it's the news media organizations. They use slightly different words to make their coverage stand out, and like people see, oh, it's an omnibus bill. I've never heard of this before. It must be something new and interesting. And it's like, no, this is exactly the same thing before, and they're just using slightly different words to get your attention.
That's what I think it is. It's just, it's weird, and it's, yeah, I think it's meant to just attract the eyes and the clicks. Anyway, in this bill was, well, originally, when this bill was going through committee, it did not have something called the Save America's Pastime Act as a part of it.
Excuse me, I almost vomited there.
It's okay.
Never heard the name before.
But in the finalized version, shortly before it was voted on, they tacked on a separate act that had been introduced called Save America's Pastime Act. Save America's Pastime Act was put forth by two congressmen, Democrat and Republican, and it attempts to cut off at the pass some lawsuits that are going on right now where minor league baseball players are suing Major League Baseball for violating labor laws. And the main premise is that they get paid a salary that if you actually took how much time they worked, because they work more than 40 hours a week, would be less than minimum wage. So their argument is that that should be illegal. And
that's pretty simple and comprehensible.
Yeah, it's I don't have it in front of me, but it's 1938, Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. And, you'd think that would be...
That's a huge bit of legislation, actually.
And they, this mostly affects the low-level minor league baseball players, which, when I say low-level, I don't mean less talented. They're either highly talented and less experienced, or just less talented. But that it's every player goes through these low levels on their way up to the major leagues.
Yeah, the farm leagues.
And it was something like they were getting paid like $1,100 a week. And if you, but they're working more than 40 hours. They're working 50-plus hours.
Easily, especially if you include transport time, like they're riding in the buses between the stadiums.
Travel time, which a lot of, People with jobs get paid for travel time. That's very common.
Yeah.
But they don't. And so, where do I start here? So, there's the doublespeak in the title of the act, which is Save America's Pastime. And if you look at some of the quotes from some of the lobbyists that Major League Baseball has hired, which, yes, they have spent a lot of money lobbying Congress, though supposedly not specifically for this act, but my gut tells me that's not true, but supposedly not. And they claim that, well, if we had to pay them for all the time that they worked, baseball as we know it would collapse and not exist anymore, which is...
This is like the same argument that businessmen always make. It's like, oh, if you increase my costs, I can't do this anymore, and you love this. So they're like holding our pastime hostage for a tax break, or in this case, a change in legislation.
Yeah, and if you, just to put this in perspective, baseball players, I don't know the exact number, but ballpark average salary combined for a major league team per year is, let's say, I'm guessing it's about $100-120 million, which is 56% last number I saw, at least last year, of the revenue of the team.
And that's pretty typical for a business that, because, you know, people are always the biggest expense.
Yeah, but this isn't all people. I mean, just to be clear, this is just the Major League Baseball players. There's something called a 40-man roster, which are the players that are now part of the union.
So there's no salary cap in baseball with, like, football? Interesting.
Mm-mm.
So the New York Yankees can get a disproportionate advantage.
Yes, they can. Although there is something called, they call it the luxury tax, I believe.
Revenue-sharing program?
I think it's, everyone over that amount pays a fine to baseball, and then I don't know if that gets shared out or just used for other expenses.
Yeah, I think I've heard a little bit about that, and I think that gets shared out to, like, the lower-grossing teams.
Yeah, and then there's just also some revenue-sharing in terms of national contracts they'd have. You know, TV contracts and all that kind of gets spread equally. Otherwise, most of baseball is funded by ticket sales and local media revenue. So part of the reason the Yankees or California teams have more money is because their markets are bigger, so the amount of people watching TV and the ads during their games is much, much more. And so they have these contracts, whereas in Wisconsin, we have Detroit, Chicago,
Minneapolis,
even St. Louis just down there, you know, all surrounding us. So the actual TV area for the Wisconsin team, the Milwaukee Brewers, is really low. So anyway, 56% of revenue goes to the major league players. All of the rest would go towards ownership and other expenses, which is probably a lot.
Maintenance.
Yeah, but... So there's a couple competing factors keeping down the minor leagues, which I think is important. It's not all just the billionaire owners, although that's a big deal, obviously. So billionaire owners, they are all super rich. All their teams, I mean, the Milwaukee Brewers are worth like a billion or a couple billion or something, and they're like one of the lower end teams.
Wow.
These teams are worth a lot of money. They make a lot of money. Maybe not as much as, like, a football team, but they make a lot of money.
Maybe this is a question beyond your knowledge or experience, but how much of that value is based on their relationship to Miller Park and their access to it?
I guess I don't know exactly for the Brewers, but in general, a team's value would be... Yes, part of it would be if they own the stadium. So mm-hmm. Some teams own the stadium. I don't know exactly in the Brewers' case because there was a lot of... Yeah, so they own it. So I think the Brewers would have some sort of lease where they lease from the county / the county has like an exclusive contract, probably insisting that the team stays for a certain number of years after it's built. is usually part of those deals. Like, you have, the team has to stay here. If we're building the stadium, you have to stay for 25 years or something like that.
Yeah, that seems pretty standard.
So, yes, that contract would probably factor into it and the revenue you get from the stadium and parking and all that. Some teams, like I know the Yankees, they totally built their giant stadium themselves. They didn't take any public money.
Interesting.
Because they didn't need to. It's not because they're, like, good guys. So the ownership, super rich, keeping down the little guys. But then also, it's important to mention that there is a weird classist thing going on with the Major League Baseball players and their union. So though they all came up through the minor leagues, and they all did that, and they all were subjugated to those working conditions, they also make more money for themselves by not bargaining with the minor league players in mind, if that makes sense. So it's unlikely that if minor leaguers were to be paid more money, it probably wouldn't come out of the 44% that isn't major league players' money. It would probably come out of their 56%.
Go on.
And so the amount of money really wouldn't be that much. That's why I brought up the amount of money that an average team makes. So if the Milwaukee Brewers' payroll this year is $100 million, I mean, we could do the math on it. But to just make sure they're at least getting paid a living wage. And that's just as a seasonal employee, because that's another thing going on here. Minor league baseball players don't work year-round. A lot of them get jobs in the off-season.
Because you have to. You only work like 5 months out of the year.
Or they maybe even go to a different, like, a lot of them play baseball in the Dominican or in Mexico for the winter. It's called winter ball. But, you know, they're not getting paid that much in the Dominican.
That's mostly for training purposes.
Yeah, that's because you either have no other abilities in life except baseball, or, yes, you're long-term just trying to get in as much pitching and hitting and throwing and catching as you can to hopefully then, you know, earn yourself some checks in the future in Major League Baseball.
Is there a separation in baseball between players who can kind of finance themselves through that and the ones who are kind of dependent on it?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that because it kind of reminds me of college athletics in that there's an advantage in terms of just day-to-day living for a college player whose parents can help pay for costs that are not included in your college scholarship. And so in baseball, yes, I'm sure that is a thing. It's also just getting to that point, there's a little bit of a classist thing going on. There's all these baseball academies and AAU teams and all of this. And this stuff either costs direct money or indirect money because parents are having to drive you around, and
especially for the
transport
national teams.
Buy bats and buy gloves and buy shoes and yeah, it's not that easy.
So it's that parking lot bias.
Yeah. Obviously, there are players who could come up through poverty through. Probably just sheer talent. There are some organizations that
probably foster
cater
that.
To.
Yeah.
They cater to like inner cities and things like that. And I'm sure there are players that have come up through those organizations. I mean, because in the end, it's all just Major League Baseball trying to get the best talent because they'll make more money with it. This isn't like altruistic here.
Yeah.
They also, in predominantly the Dominican Republic. They have, almost every team nowadays has this, where they have a facility down there where they get 12 to 16-year-old kids, and they train them, they coach them up, they play them, they just give them minimal equipment, and...
The ones who shine at the minimum level are, you know, stars.
Yeah, I think, like, at 16, they can sign them. I could be wrong about the age, but I think it's at 16 you can sign them. And then they go off to the minor leagues. It's important to note that then in the minor leagues, though they aren't making much money, those foreign-born players are kind of taken care of. I recently heard the Houston Astros, who just won the World Series, actually every year have like a graduation ceremony for their Latin kids that everyone in the organization comes to. It actually kind of sounds fun. Everyone comes to because they teach these Latin kids English, and then when they graduate, they have like a big ceremony for
them.
That's
super cool.
It sounds kind of cute and fun. And then they do other things. They help teach financial literacy, kind of, here's what America's like, you know, here's how to order a pizza, that type of
thing. Yeah, don't sign credit forms.
Yeah, basic English and that type of stuff. They do help with these foreign kids because they're making an investment in, you know, even if they're not paying them that much salary right now. Well, some of them they do because there are signing bonuses. So some of these players in single A ball might get paid $1,100 a week, but they signed a $500,000 signing bonus when they were drafted.
Oh, nice.
But that's really rare. And I think that's important here. The number of players that get $1,500,000, $100,000 even signing bonus, it's a drop in the bucket. There's a big chunk that gets like $50,000, which, if you manage your money well, could definitely help you through those couple years.
Yeah, that's a year of salary right there.
But you're not living like a king.
No, certainly not.
You know,
I mean, maybe in like the farm towns, you'll feel like a king because
maybe, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, this is kind of like a primer on the financial bureaucracy of baseball. This law is definitely, so the way I understand it, it should put the kibosh on these lawsuits that are class action lawsuits filed by minor league players or former minor league players. It in general, from what I understand about the industry, like the journalists, they're really against this. One of the articles I was reading, I think it might have been a Reuters article, a Forbes article, otherwise, Washington Post did like the big one right before the bill was signed. Anyways, one of the articles I was written was quoting someone, and it was anonymously quoting them, which tells me this is probably someone involved in a front office in Major League Baseball, though not the owner, obviously. Which tells me, I don't know, I'm thinking there's a lot of people involved in the bureaucracy of baseball who don't like this, actually. And this is mostly the owners and maybe the corporation of Major League Baseball itself pushing this legislation and legislation like it.
Because they're accountants and are trying to drive down costs. They're looking at it in purely dollar terms, but if I can interrupt...
I mean, it's a classic, like, capitalist.
Yeah, if I can interrupt a little, like, I can understand why people in the front office would be against this, because... Why would any new baseball player, if you are genuinely talented, why would you go into that sport when obviously they... Yeah, I don't... There's no upward mobility that you can depend on. They're just going to try to extract everything that they can out of you. I don't know. It's... Yeah.
Well, no. Yeah, so...
But that keeps, like, the teams, like, say 5 to 10 years from now, the kids that are going through the farm leagues won't... You won't get, you know, the same number and the same talent, and that's just terrible for baseball in general.
Yeah, so baseball has had a problem for some years now where they think that the best athletes are not coming to baseball. They go to football, they go to basketball. And that's a little bit in contrast to right now, baseball is considered to be having a youth movement at the major league level. Although I would argue a lot of that is being propped up by these Latin players, which, if you're from the Dominican Republic, $1,100 a month sounds fucking awesome. their minimum wage is different than our minimum wage.
Yeah, their standard living is a little bit different.
Yeah, it's poorer there. It just straight up is. And if they get into the minor leagues, they can at least work their ass off and have a shot. But I don't think we should be changing our laws to the low standards of the Dominican Republic, to the unfortunately low standards of the Dominican Republic. You know, like our minimum wage should not be based off of the living conditions
in a third country,
the Dominican. Yeah.
So they're bringing the race to the bottom to baseball.
Yeah, and that's like they're quoting these guys who are like, "Oh, I would hate for a minor league baseball player for us to have to tell him that he can't go out there and take extra batting practice. Oh, I would just hate for that to happen." Completely ignoring that it's like, no, you would hate to pay him to do that.
You would love him to do that, but.
Yes, you just don't want to pay him more to do that. The reason you're telling him he can't do that is because you're putting a cap on his hours, which they wouldn't do, by the way. If this law wouldn't have passed, and Major League Baseball would have lost these lawsuits, which they actually have a really good record of not losing these lawsuits, but if they were, and they had to pay some overtime or maybe just pay them like a higher salary, which is, I think, the way it would work out, is that you just pay them, let's say, a salary that would be minimum wage at 60 hours a week or something.
Right, because
like
that's typically what's done with like those kind of salary positions. They're calculated and we'll give you this many. Yeah, but it's nuts that that minimum wage would be such an improvement for them.
Yeah,
I mean minimum wage isn't even that high. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, in this stupid law that passed, they raised it to from $1,100 to $1,160.
Ooh.
They gave him a $60 a month raise.
Which is going to be taxed higher, so you end up with like $42. Like, oh, go out to a nice meal and get a couple of drinks on us. You can do it once a year, and so you're grateful to us, right? No, I'm sorry. It's
yeah. You know, when I first had the idea for a podcast called Tell Me What to Think, I always imagined it would be me asking. It's kind of like how it is. Like, I ask you questions about things that I don't know that much about. And then I would always do a little sports segment. So yeah, I always pictured it. So this is the first sports segment that I've been able to do on here. And it's about baseball, my favorite sport. And it's about classism and injustice to the lower, to the working man, so it's even better. The last thing I'll say, though, is this is like kind of unrelated, but Mitch McConnell was apparently a big backer of this bill, though he's not the person that proposed it, but he was like, you know, he's leadership, he's why this got in. And he apparently is a, quote, diehard Washington Nationals fan. Now, I know Kentucky does not have a baseball team in Kentucky, but there is the Cincinnati team right there. You know, I mean, Cincinnati spills over into Kentucky.
Sure, Louisville shares a media market with Cincinnati, don't they? Or it's close enough to, almost.
Well, I mean, if you go to Cincinnati, like the one time I was there, we stayed in Kentucky. We stayed in a suburb that was just felt like it was part of Cincinnati.
Just across the river.
That just happened to be on the other side of the river. And so, anyway, I just think it speaks to him being a Washington swamp creature that he can't even like have a fake local team to root for. His favorite team's Washington because he's been there for 35 years. So, anyway, just thought I'd leave with a little bit of Mitch McConnell trivia. Trying to steal all my infinity jewels. Look, jewels, gems, I really don't give a fuck. Professor X fell out his wheelchair, nobody picked him up. Aquaman asked him if he needed a hand. Popeye was trying to smoke all of his green out of can. Swamp Thing was swimming with the Animal Man, and the Ninja Turtles just robbed the Pizza Man. Somebody told Shill and they sent Maria Hill to investigate the Domino's crime. Now Starfire's topless and I can't stop it, but the Titans say she do it all the time. Johnny Blaze, all right. Johnny Storm, that he light was up the blunt, hop in the car, turn up the bass. We have a hip hop test drive. Today we are doing the album A Strange Journey into the Unimaginable by MERS. And it says right on the cover, so I'm going to mention it too, produced by Michael Seven Summers. And I'm guessing that's the picture of the other guy on the cover of the album here. So, must be important to him. All right. Initial thoughts? You want to go through the ODB breakdown?
Well, it's typical of Matt, of Maris's ODB profile. Super abstract. Mm-hmm. Commercially accessible without being commercially promoted.
I'd agree.
And it's hardcore in the fact that, like, the first album, like, the first track on this album is a suicide track, and he doesn't... It's like he's just trying to pump the blood out of his cuts through the rest of it.
Yeah. It has a... The album seemed a little bit in terms of, I don't know how it exactly fits into that, but, it was... There were a lot of songs written, like, to a love interest. Presumably his wife, I'm guessing.
That's pretty typical with his albums. Like, a lot of his songs are about women that he knows or women that he has a relationship with.
Yeah, and there's kind of like a... Like, there's a theme through a few of the songs of, like, the people, the family or friends of this woman that he's in love with hate him. Like, he kept referencing in different songs. I agree, though. It's pretty abstract. Hardcore... In terms of, like, gangster drug use type stuff, it has some references. There's a song about drinking, but most of them just seem more like... Like, there was one cool song, which is the a Lean Story.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I really loved that.
That was super cool. It was about obtaining... I don't know, what is lean? I'm out of it. I think it's, like...
What did he... It was...
It's, like, codeine and...
Yeah, it was codeine. Like, powdered codeine.
Yeah.
It's like a barbiturate, so it makes you super duper groggy and leaning. I can understand why that's an easy slang for it.
Yeah, okay. And but even like the way he tells the story, it's not like bragging about it really. It's just like telling a story.
Right, and that's why the hardcore in the ODB scale is like a reference to, you know, the true to life. It isn't necessarily gangster the trapping or weapon use or drug use. It's just, you know, how feels how like? True does it feel?
Yeah, which I mean, I would say then it's really high.
Yeah, it hits on the hardcore level.
Yeah, it's a lot of the songs are kind of about depression, about relationship problems, about touring, music stories. Yeah. What was your favorite song?
Ah, man. Lo-fi or unimaginable. I really liked the Lean Story, but in terms of abstractness, it's like superhero pool party is fits with another formula of Merce's, like the Saturday cartoon track that he did a few albums ago, where it's like he has this little skit of an intro and then it goes into like super abstract themed poetry.
God is the Greatest, I actually really liked that song. This is the last track. I thought that was... It just had, like, a cadence to it that was a little different than his other ones. The music was a little different than the other ones. I just thought it was really... Like, I was just, like, right along with the song. But, yes, my favorite song was Superhero Pool Party. I love that type of stuff. I love the comic book references. I like thick songs with like just tons of references. Like GZA did those songs like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think I messaged you a couple days ago that, and I won't do 5 minutes on this, but the line "Swamp Thing." So the whole song is like talking about a superhero pool party and talking about what all the superheroes are doing. And he has the line "Swamp Thing was shrooming with the Animal Man." Do you know the histories of those two characters and why that line is awesome?
I don't quite understand why it's so awesome, but I'm only vaguely familiar with it. Like, Animal Man, I'm not sure who he is.
Yeah. Okay, so Swamp Thing and Animal Man are two old characters that had resurgences in the 80s. And they are known for... So Swamp Thing was brought back by Alan Moore. Animal Man was brought back by Grant Morrison. They were both for lack of a better term, trippy comics. Swamp Thing had, like, this weird, surreal, like, 60s vibe to it. Animal Man was written by a guy who believes in, like, Grant Morrison genuinely believes in magic and the occult. Huh. And he loves to break the fourth wall. He does that shit all the time. And they were just both weird, different comics that led to a lot of the good storytelling you've seen since then. Alan Moore and Grant Morrison are two of the titans of comic book writing, at least. I don't know if they are doing much nowadays, I'm not entirely sure, but for 20 years, they were two of the biggest and best. Alan Moore did Watchmen.
Yeah.
And the Shrooming, yeah, those are two characters that's a perfect little thing about that you'd only know if you were super into 80s obscure DC comics. which he is. Like, I can tell. He didn't just randomly do that. No, who brings up Animal Man? Like, you didn't even know who Animal Man was.
Or
you know, Merce knows his shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, he knows his shit, and I loved that. When I heard that, I'm like, oh, man, dude knows comics. Dude knows comics really well, if he knows that. This actually, I don't have like a ton glowing to say beyond I think this is my new favorite album that we've reviewed on the show.
Interesting.
I don't have, yeah, I it's just good. It's just really good. It's really listenable.
Hits on all
from
cylinders.
Beginning to end. Yes. It's not as dancey and like upbeat as,
Cupcake.
Yeah, Cupcakes. I don't think he's necessarily as funny as Cupcake, but he's still funny, he's still clever, and he's not going for that either. He's doing a totally different type of album than her.
Right, and he's not trying to really dig deep into his own veins like Sci-Hi was.
Yeah, and actually, I think he's just a better rapper than Sci-Hi. I think he's just...
Yeah, well, experience is one thing.
Yeah, he's not like extremely... You know, it didn't have, like, the flashy rhymes.
Well, there's guest something spots about we're his... trying. It was kind of, yeah. It's kind of the guest spot thing of underground hip-hop, but that's... I know people generally get better when they have other people on the tracks, but in this album it seemed like the people who were being brought on were trying for those really pointed, catchy rhymes when Merce was just doing what he does.
Yeah, he's just... He's a storyteller. He's a storyteller, and... I liked his stories. And man, like, if you can, without all the style and without all the pizzazz, have something that is as memorable and hits home as much, like, that's almost that much better. Like, you don't, it's like a good movie. Like, sometimes there's just movies that are so fucking good, and it's just because there's a good story with good dialogue, and it's not flashy, it's not trick shots, it just, is a good story that hits home with you, and to me, this album was like that. Whereas all the other ones we've listened to so far, just didn't have that core that was as good. And it's nothing against those albums; they maybe didn't have anything to say as much as he does, and definitely not experience. I don't think anyone we listen to has been around as long as him, except maybe
Eminem.
Well, we didn't that one wasn't actually in a episode.
What?
No, that one didn't make it into an episode.
Wait, we didn't do Revival? We recorded it and didn't... Okay, anyways, people, there's a whole...
Because there were recording issues.
It messaged us for guest content. We can never...
The curtain's been lifted away. now everyone knows. There's a lost Eminem hip-hop test drive.
Huh.
Actually, I have the version on my computer. It just wasn't that good. But yeah, I mean, Eminem, obviously, he's been around. I mean, but Murs is not that much younger, right?
No, they're from pretty much the same generation, or have to be,
yeah,
right?
I think so.
Murs might actually have been around longer, because, you know, Scribble Jam 97 is when Marshall Mathers really became Eminem.
Yeah, and then he came out with the
Slim Shady LP.
Yeah. around that time. So
it was 99? Anyway, yeah.
98, I think. But yeah, around then. Anyway. So yeah, I'm super on board with this album. I think it's one of my favorite. How would you kind of... What do you think?
I don't know. 5 stars? We really... as I said, it hits on all the appropriate measures on the ODB scale, so...
Yeah.
Yeah. 5 out of 5.
Yep. All right. That's been Hip Hop Test Drive. And we will be back with closing thoughts. Put out the blunt and all of that.
Man, where's that air freshener?
We talked about vulture capitalism and its effects on retail chains last week. And since that happened, well, in the episode, I posed the question, aren't the toy makers going to have a problem with Toys R Us going out of business? And at least one of them said yes. And the owner of Bratz, which if you don't know what it is, good, Bratz Toys, started a GoFundMe with...
Are those little, like, girl figurines? Okay.
Yeah, they're kind of, like, trashy.
Yeah, okay, I can see why that guy might be concerned about market share if he had to rely on an image and product.
Oh, and I guess he's based out of Vegas, so it's like, oh, that explains the look a little bit.
I understand what you're going for, yeah, okay.
And so he, along with some unnamed other... Maybe it does say it on the thing, but not an article. Toy manufacturer started a GoFundMe page. They, last I read, which was yesterday, I believe, they had a 200-300 million. They're going for $1 billion. I haven't heard from Toys R Us if they're like, yes, you can buy us for $1 billion, because I don't know that that's going to be that easy.
No, I don't think so. They're already in reorganization, so...
Yeah, there's all these, like, stories online about them having liquidation sales and stuff, so...
Yeah, they're already poised to, like, sell off everything down to, like, the stores and maybe even the branding, so...
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they'll be able to pick it up on the cheap and reorganize the company, but even if they do, they'll be starting from scratch and putting themselves on the back foot.
Yeah. But, yeah, so we thought that was a little interesting that, yes.
I'd also like to point out that if they're doing a GoFundMe, like, that's, like, you know, innovative, like, cutting-edge finance being used to, like, solve... Well, late-stage capitalism problems.
Yes.
Although I don't like that phrase.
No, I thought it was weird, though. Like, this is how you're going to try and buy Toys R Us? Is it a GoFundMe?
I thought those were typically private affairs where CEOs would, like, have stake and talk about how much money they can put together to buy something.
Yeah, yeah. That's isn't that how the world works? Or used to? Or I don't know. Time's moving fast. We also wanted to bring up, which is becoming a short weekly segment now, more rotten cabinetry.
Oh my god, right?
You had something about Wilbur Ross.
All right, but yeah, Wilbur Ross apparently didn't properly divest himself from a particular Chinese shipping firm, even though he filed ethics reports that said that he did.
So just not just withheld information, just straight up lied?
Yeah, just straight up lied.
Okay.
Because when he became, you know, the commerce secretary, he agreed to divest himself from certain assets, and then he didn't.
That would seem pretty egregious. That would, to me, that means he should be resigning. Has he resigned?
I was just looking at Google News because something huge always seems to happen while we're recording, but he is not, as of this moment, resigned.
Okay. That's all right. People don't really resign from this administration.
No, they get fired.
Yeah, it's like when you sign up, you have to agree to not resign and let Trump fire you, I think is my whole brand.
Well, it's like, the people don't resign because where are you going to go from here? Like, being a part of this administration kind of, like, puts a nice little tie at the end of your career. So if you leave, there's not very much on the outside except apparently running his re-election campaign. Can't believe those people should be behind bars, not like in some corporate office suite, trying to figure out how they can continue to impose a fascist agenda against the common interests and values of the American people.
You mean like Parscale and
how they just kind of graduated to? Well, they moved sideways into the private sector supporting Trump.
All right, and then there was a little bit of news about Pruitt's travel expenses, I believe.
Oh, yeah, crew concerned her citizens for responsible ethics in Washington got a hold of his records. But, yeah, Scott Pruitt apparently spent more than $120,000 on security and travel costs for just one trip to Italy last year.
Yikes.
Yeah, it's apparently he's running up the government credit card just like
Carson and
the Walking Lizard Mnuchin is.
The Walking what? Lizard?
Yeah. He's just kind of a lizard man who's wearing a John Oliver costume.
It still doesn't fit quite right.
No, that's why his chin doesn't look right.
So it's pretty common. I feel like this kind of improper spending is not hitting home, and I don't know if it's because the average person thinks there's more important things. The average person just doesn't care. The media thinks there's more important things. The media... I don't know exactly what, but this type of shit would have been huge scandals in the 90s.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting. Like, the liberals of, you know, people who are to the left, notionally, are outraged by this, as well they should be. Like, if you... Whether or not... However you feel about the state, if you're liberal, you probably are against this. But the conservatives, of course, which side is going to object? The people who are big business, who are like, yes, we should absolutely be able to use the government like our own corporate piggy bank? Or the people who are against government, who see this as like, oh, they're just spending money in a way that doesn't project government power, which also works in their interest.
That's an okay, I haven't... That last bit, I haven't thought of as to why they wouldn't object. Because like, you normally think of these people as kind of like, well, I don't like government spending, and to me this seems like a terrible case of government overspending.
Well, yeah, but the other side of that is if they don't spend the money well, that's what they might as well not be spending it at all.
Yeah, it's just, the Steve Bannon bringing down the system.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of Steve Bannon, we have
I'd like to offer all of our listeners an emphatic apology for my misstating a fact from our last episode. Steve Bannon was not, in fact, CEO of Cambridge Analytica. He was just a special assistant, or somebody who worked at the company, who the CEO reported to.
Yes. He was, by most reports, he was... if not single-handedly running the company, directing the company, he was one of the major figures in it as of two, three, four years ago.
It's all just super sleazy, the way he operates. Like, he runs the company but doesn't have any position that would require, you know, mandatory reporting requirements, especially to the British, because I'm sure they regulate their stock market even more closely than... Our federal bureaucracy would.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Shady.
Yeah. Shady. I think that's like his nickname back in college.
Shady Steve Bannon.
In the Navy. Like, there's something about you, Steve. You're just shady. I don't know what it is, but you're just fucking shady. Speaking of tech companies, there is a really kind of damning article by Wired and it's about something I ranted, well...
Another recurring segment.
Yeah. I ranted about just the name of Palantir a few weeks ago, but we didn't really actually get that much into...
why it's terrible in our modern society.
Yeah. Yeah, like what the company actually does. That's so awful. Well, Wired, written by... what do they put the author's name at the end of the article here? What's going on?
Mark Harris.
Oh, Mark Harris. Yeah, it's right there at the top. It's above the headline.
In
how about that?
Super small letters.
Yeah. Yeah, it's faint on my phone here. Anyway, Palantir is getting its hands into local law enforcement.
Right, and it's been...
And, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's been trying to do this for a few years now, but now that they've been there for a while, people are able to acquire piles of documents. In this particular case, they looked at Southern California in the Los Angeles Basin area.
And what is kind of the crux of the article? Part of it is that there's not a proper cordoning off of this information.
Right. There were 177 cases of what otherwise might be called bad actors in this. Well, across, especially for a place like an area like Los Angeles, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of individual jurisdictions that have access to this data. So 177 bad cases isn't necessarily... I mean, obviously it's alarming, but statistically, that's actually kind of good.
Okay.
But yeah, the article painted a pretty damning portrait of the company. Like, apparently the only reason that this was widely adopted at the Los Angeles Area Fusion Center was because of a particular relationship that somebody had and recommended it for procurement without any kind of competitive process. It was just like, oh, Palantir does these things. Like, they didn't even submit a request for the requirements in their initial procurement request. They just kind of left it blank, so Palantir, like, slithered in like the ooze that Peter Thiel is to occupy the space and suck Los Angeles County dry, apparently. Because, yeah, the Palantir itself, like, will sell what it calls cores, like servers that are allegedly configured for their software, but in actuality, they're just commercial off-the-shelf software that, or hardware that the company overcharges these jurisdictions. And then they, of course, get a subscription fee to the actual software on them. And then there's additional support costs. Like, apparently, there's like $1 million retroactive request that triggered auditing. Wasn't necessarily illegal, but it wasn't... like, they weren't supposed to be able to actively charge things to the county's budget, which is what kind of Palantir forced them into. But what Palantir is, I guess, is a slightly different question. It's just a operating system. Like, there are, 29 applications that run off of this platform, but it just combines disparate data sources into something that police or law enforcement intelligence analysts can use to visualize data and make easier connections than they would if they just had to, read the whole exhaustive case file to notice, this one address appears in, an incident report that isn't even necessarily connected to this, the whole file that you're looking at, or what you might otherwise be looking at. But, yeah, there's, license plate recognition, traffic citations, every possible data point that is produced by interactions between the public and law enforcement end up getting put into this huge data set that Palantir controls access to. And just like Facebook, the more widely it's adopted, the more widely it's adopted and becomes its own kind of critical mass where police agencies might not be able to use anything but it because they need all these... They notionally need access to this data. But one thing that I thought kind of was an underwhelming burying of a lead in this story is that they mentioned jail visitation records are also included in this. Can you imagine the guilt by association? You're visiting somebody who... Yeah, in jail, just because they're your friend or you've known them, but all of a sudden you might be hyper-investigated because you went and saw them in jail and provided, like, the most basic humanitarian regard for another human being that you can provide.
So, that would be something that normally would be accessible information by law enforcement, but maybe not easily accessible, like readily available.
Right, it's not being shoved into your face as you're looking at it. Well, and this, like, because yeah. Palantir's, what they do is they use it to draw leads for further investigation, which reinforces the baked-in bias of these data sets.
Wait, Palantir shows you the leads?
That's part of the visualization. Like, it'll help you, search through the data that that's contained in its databases for, possibly related information.
That's pretty wild. That's like, it's almost more like Minority Report.
Yeah, which is why I brought up that address thing, because, like, the incident reports, like, even, and tips are also included in this, so somebody could just give a tip about a certain address that isn't properly filed, or what in the past wouldn't have been properly filed, but now, all of a sudden, somebody investigating in the Fusion Center can, search that address and see those disparate and possibly unconnected incident reports, and maybe even draw conclusions that are only, it's the problem with data is it isn't, necessarily clear what the context is for these, these data sets, and so there might be conflicting or, other complications from using them together.
The fact that this is not a public, I would think courts might have an issue with this.
Yeah, there just seems to be
because
issues.
Yeah, because it's like if a computer program owned by a private company is telling you what probable cause is, do we all know, is it open knowledge exactly how it does all this stuff? I would imagine
not.
No, because
it's all proprietary. Like, the police officers themselves don't even understand what's going on with this data behind Palantir's silk screen, because they're not allowed to.
Yeah, and not that... I'm sure we could come up with more nuanced ones, but like a ham-handed what if would be like, what if they put in there like a racial profiling thing?
Well, that's the problem with these.
But it was secretive.
Yeah, the problem with this programming, and it's kind of seen in facial recognition, is that people bake in their own bias. Like, the way a programmer sees the world is how the program that he writes is also going to see the world. So if you're racist or you're classist or... Yeah, it will inevitably filter into later interpretations of data sets. It's that baked-in bias.
Yeah.
And it's also...
That's pretty wild.
It also relies on past data to predict future trends without, modern or current developments. So if you think there has always been crime here, so there always will be crime there, then police are going to act like that and, possibly impugn the civil liberties of people who are just otherwise going about their lives in an area that, for some odd reason, the police think is high crime, when it might not actually be it, that, because things change, and what is a high crime area a decade ago isn't necessarily a high crime area now.
Yeah, yeah. Huh. But if you heavily police it, it could stay a high crime area.
Right, because the police are generating reports.
Yeah. It's kind of one of the problems with the stats, policing stats, is that there's a, it's like a Heisenberg, isn't that like a Heisenberg bias, where it's because you keep measuring this, because you keep policing this area, you're going to get more traffic stops and speeding tickets, whereas if you did that same thing to another area that you think is low crime, you might get higher numbers there
as
well.
It might give a bump in the crime statistics, which officers, or, especially police management, doesn't like to see. Which is an interesting, slightly different and related question. But with the parallel construction, I don't know if we've ever talked about this on the pod, but a few years ago, years ago, when Edward Snowden released the NSA or blew up the terrorist surveillance program, the TSP that was created by Dick Cheney, one thing that they were doing is that they were taking the intelligence that they were accumulating and gathering. If it had a domestic law enforcement purpose, they would give it to the DEA, and they would go through a process called parallel construction. Like, we know this person, like, at this time and date, is going to be shipping drugs. We can't explain our probable cause clearly in the indictment and documents, and so we'll find other ways to also know this, so that when we pull that person over, we can say that it wasn't because of, like, stingrays or any other kind of potentially illegal surveillance measure that we're implementing, but because of other information that, you know, they might not necessarily have been able to or even known to have looked for if they didn't already know, you know?
Yes.
And so what this kind of data that Palantir creates is, like, if you find a crime, yeah, you can, again, look for other ways to also know about that crime and not mention anything about it in the reporting documents, like with stingrays.
Yeah. That would seem to be... So that would seem to be unconstitutional, but it's hard to prove if you...
Right, because...
don't have the records, which the whole point of it is to not...
Right, which is why Palantir, even according to this article, doesn't release any kind of metrics. Like, police departments were like, how effective is this? Can you tell us or show us numbers about how effective this is? And they're like, no, proprietary data.
All right. And then let's finish up
I guess I want to say one more point about this, but all of this money that's being spent on Palantir and, like, finding future crime is money that isn't going to patrolling officers and equipment that patrolling officers need if they want to do, like, you know, more community policing actions or more local, like, familiarity operations, the things that people say that they want out of their police. No, instead it's being given to Peter Thiel. So, enjoy that.
Put into his pockets.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
So you want to mention this related side note about we found out this morning?
Oh. I have yet to see a thorough article about this, so I didn't want to get into it too much, but apparently Palantir employees might have been volunteering their time to Cambridge Analytica in 2016.
Because Peter Thiel was a big Trump supporter.
Yeah, so somehow Palantir's tied up with that. The Cambridge story as well. That was coming... from
the leaker. It was being reported by somebody from...
Yeah, yes.
Attributing that leaker.
From The Guardian through... Yeah. Chris... Whatever his name is. I have it right here, actually. This is all according to Christopher Wiley. Yeah. The leaker from Cambridge Analytica. And being reported by Justin Hendricks and Carol Cadwallader.
However you pronounce that.
Cadwallader? Wallader. Anyway. Alright, and to finish up...
MBS.
Yeah, MBS came to the U.S. He's probably just about leaving now? It was supposed to be long trip.
He might still be in America somewhere, but...
Okay.
Yeah, apparently, as reported by Ryan Grimm in The Guardian, MBS has been heard to have said that he has Jared Kushner in his pocket, which is incredibly disturbing on an optics level. But as part of this reporting, it came to light that Jared Kushner shared with may or may not have shared with MBS names of people who were against his realigning of the royal family over there and his consolidation of power.
Sorry to interrupt, but just so I don't make you feel bad. Ryan Grimm in The Intercept.
Yeah.
Right? You said Garcia.
Thank you for that.
It's okay. It's okay.
All right. But, in The Intercept. Kushner gave him a list of names that are apparently intelligence community knew that were opposed to this, and those people ended up and caught up in MBS's subsequent roundup of notionally corrupt individuals, and at least one of them was tortured literally to death.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Jared Kushner, who probably shouldn't have had access to that data to begin with because of his terrible security clearance situation, literally gave that to a tyrant to further his own ends, possibly in contravention to American interests, because I'd kind of like to see a more of a democracy show up in Saudi Arabia.
Well, and this is after the Qataris. Is that how you say Qataris?
Qataris, yeah.
Qataris refused to bail out his company.
Oh, I didn't even consider that,
Yeah, so he goes to Qatar to some... I don't know if it's to, like, the
government. The sovereign.
I don't know exactly how these things are... tries to get them to...
bail him out on his 666 West project.
Yep, and they refuse. And then all of a sudden, there's this purge in Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia goes hard after Qatar.
Actually, that happened over the summer. I don't know. Is it before the purge? The embargo?
Well, yeah, yeah. But, I don't know. I'm not saying it's all a neat, tight little package with all of that.
It's a sprawling mess. It's only going to get worse.
Yes. It's a complicated web of lies. What is MBS doing in the United States?
Apparently, it appears to be a public relations visit. About a week or so ago, he had a, which I guess is a slightly related segment, or follow-up. The war in Yemen is going to continue because, who was it? Bernie and a couple of other senators, Chris Murphy, I think was the other one, sponsored a bill to force a new reauthorization of our involvement in the war in Yemen. And like hours before, most of the Senate was in a reception with MBS. And a couple hours later, of course, vote to continue the war in Yemen. I can only imagine what he said in those remarks, or what he may have said in that cocktail party.
Well, to be honest, most of them probably don't need much convincing.
Yeah, I suppose.
But yeah. It's... Bernie... the kind of bright side of it, if you will, is that... correct me if I'm wrong, but the impression I got is that the Senate hadn't really directly voted on this at all.
This was based on the 2001 authorization for the use of military force. Cheney's blank
check. So this got senators on the record on this specific use of force.
Well, it's kind of sprawling. I mean, if it's...
Wasn't it specifically
I mean, our involvement there is kind of sprawling in its nature because we're providing intelligence to the Saudis and fuel for their planes and the munitions that they drop, but somehow we're not involved and not culpable for human rights or war crimes.
Well, so far neither is Saudi Arabia.
Well, they don't care, but notionally we do.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose that's a good point. All right. Well, anything else you want to say about MBS there?
Yeah, not really. I mean, it's just a PR stunt. Everything that he says publicly is, I don't know. With that guy, it's more important to see what actions are being taken because that's the biggest signal of motive and intent. And as part of that, this is probably also to help coordinate. Interesting that, you know, Rex Tillerson leaves at the same time. MBS is here, too, because now they're going to ratchet up their war against Iran. So look for attacks in May.
Write that down. Put it on your calendar. You could definitely see there. It's not... So the explicit purpose that he came to the United States is to... get investments into Saudi Arabia from America.
A state visit, of course.
Yeah. Which he probably is doing, and that is probably important. I mean, they aren't an they don't have an infinite amount of money there, from what I understand, with the price of oil having gone down. So they probably do need these investments.
Well, he needs,
for at least whatever purposes he needs, to prop up his future administration.
And it's that Vision 2030 project that he's doing. He's going to need the know-how and capital to enact his robot city in the desert.
Awesome. But you could definitely see that the kind of unsaid thing going on is to discuss Iran. For sure. Yeah, that makes total sense. All right. This has been Tell Me What to Think. Make sure to subscribe.
Basically, Cyberstock.
Comment. Yes, make sure to push the boundaries of what is moral in terms of a cyber presence around us and our podcast. Make sure to creepily tweet me at Bloated Nemesis.
Green Weird. And green Charles. _ WYRD.
Yes, you can email the pod at tmwttpod@gmail.com. Please don't send spam or nudes.
We will publish
this. Is Tell Me What. Yes. We will, what's that called? Where you, what's that? Where you expose someone?
I can't tell.
Email us with whatever term I'm trying to think of, because I'm totally blanking on it right now. This has been Tell Me What to Think. Thank you for listening. Destroy the myths that will break our chains. Break your chains!